This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've postponed our interview about cancer therapies with Michael Lerner so that we can pay tribute to British writer Dennis Potter. Potter was one of the most original writers working in television. Most of his work was for the BBC, including his best-known series The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven, which ran in America on public TV. Potter died today from pancreatic and liver cancer at the age of 59. His illness was diagnosed in February, and he was given 3 months to live. His passing comes just 9 days after the death of his wife, who also died of cancer. After Potter's diagnosis, he began and completed a new TV project called Cold Lazarus and completed another called Karaoke. We're going to hear an interview Potter recorded in 1992, right after the theatrical release of his film Secret Friends. In both Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective, Potter played on our desire to have life be more like it is in fiction and in the lyrics of popular songs. When a Potter character expressed his deepest thoughts, instead of speaking, he would lip-sync the lyrics of old pop records he'd hear in his mind. The Singing Detective was about a middle-aged detective writer hospitalized with a horrible disfiguring condition, a combination of extreme psoriasis and arthritis. Dennis Potter himself was often stricken with this disease. In this scene from The Singing Detective, a female nurse is applying ointment to the writer's raw thighs. The writer is gravely embarrassed to find he's getting aroused, so he tries to think boring, distracting thoughts.
We can start now.
Oh, cock, do not crow. Poor cock, do not stir.
I'll be as gentle as I can.
Oh, think of something boring, for Christ's sake. Think of something very, very, very boring. A speech. A speech by Ted Heath. A sentence, a long sentence from Bernard Levin. A quiz by Christopher Booker. Oh, no. Think. Really boring. A Welsh male voice choir. Everything in punch. Oh,
poor thing.
Oh, wage rates in Peru, James Burke, Finnegan's Wake, all the bloody Irish, the dog in blue, Peter, Brian Clough, and especially James, Henry Ann Clive, Australian barman, ecologist, semiologist, thing, guardian woman's page. Oh, dear Christ, yes, the Bible. And, oh, God, Reader's Digest, special draw prize. No. Think Bible. Bible Psalms, Song of Solomon, thy breasts are like, no.
Sorry, is that too hard?
Too hard, yes. It's like iodine in a cut.
I'm sorry, but it's worst of all just here inside your thighs. I'm being as gentle as I can.
Oh, it's not your fault. No.
I'm sorry, but I shall have to lift your penis now to grease round it.
My mama done told me when I was in pigtails.
I have to talk to you about songs.
Songs.
Because I think it's so powerful. The way you express people's inner life and inner dreams and desires through the popular songs of the 30s and 40s. Did you want to live in the world of those songs?
Many of those songs I actually hate, to be quite honest. You know, it's like what Noah Coward said about the potency of cheap music. Some of those banal and silly, syncopated, syrupy lyrics and tunes, like much popular art, they make you do all the work. I mean, in themselves, intrinsically, they may not have that much value. But even the most drivelly, syrupy, syncopated piece of mush is in direct line of descent from the Psalms, in my opinion, in that they say, or they're seeking to say, that the dead, suffocating materiality of the real world and the way we're locked into it, that there is something else shimmering, something that may be very cheap and may be very banal. But it says, you know, that love is there and is forever, or the sun is shining, or it infiltrates into that. Because it's so easy and because it's so undemanding, it makes you do the work. It's a great art, because great music demands that you genuflect before, that you bend the knee to it, you give it it demands your attention. Popular art in general makes you do the work because you put yourself into it, which is why in drama, using those songs and making the actors lip sync to them so that they're genuine artifacts from the past, like a costume would be or a piece of furniture might be, it enables me to feel as though I'm getting inside the head. And, you know, we all have this little theater on top of our shoulders, bobbing along on top of our shoulders.
Did anyone in your family sing?
My mother played the piano in the working men's club in the Forest of Dean, in the sort of coal mining village where I grew up. She sang, and she was popular as a result.
Was she transformed when she sang in any way?
Well, she was, and we were. In a sort of miners' club, for example, there's hardworking people drinking, yes. And as the evening wears on, some of the old songs would start coming out. And it was an odd place, Forest of Dean, anyway. It's like it's between the two rivers, the Wye and the Severn, on the borders of England and Wales. And was, when I was a child in the war, quite isolated and ugly villages because they were coal mining villages, but a genuine forest creeping right up to the back garden, as it were, a forest real enough to get lost in, and a landscape that was stony and green and grey and grubby all at the same time.
Your new movie, Secret Friends, is in part about the danger of fantasies and the danger of living out those fantasies. And that's really a recurrent theme in a lot of your work. And I was wondering if you lived in the fantasy world, if that was your place, coming of age in a coal mining town.
To a degree, I think everyone does to some degree. But there are fantasies and fantasies. I mean, fantasy can be one of those registrable sexual diseases, I think, for example. I mean, it can. You know that when people don't see each other true, when they don't deal with reality and allow fantasy to displace reality, you know that that is actually a form of illness. Yeah, but without some fantasy of some order or some... It's a kissing cousin to imagination, isn't it? And without that imagination to leaven and in a sense order our experience, then we're less than human.
Another related theme that recurs in a lot of your work is growing up in a very repressive atmosphere, repressive parents, repressive teachers. Was that true for you? Did you grow up in a repressive atmosphere?
Well, I wouldn't say it was repressive. I mean, it had standards and had that right-wing part of myself will come out in a minute because I do believe that those kinds of respect for order and decency and the working class culture that I grew up in coincided also with the fact that the world was mad. I mean, there were German planes overhead, making that peculiar broken noise, so you knew they were the German planes. They go, rather than one continuous note, and each horizon lit by searchlights. The assumption, the first long word I ever learned, I used to love words as a child, I still do actually, but were the teachers leaning over the railings and opposite, there's this little village school and the oak trees opposite where we played. And I heard that France had capitulated. I loved the word capitulated. I didn't know what it meant. Ran all the way home. But capitulated in my mouth like a pebble, you know, like it was a jewel. Like a word, lovely, new, long word. I was five. But that was the word. So of course, all those things were affecting the way one grew up, that the normal condition was there were Germans trying to kill you. And the assumption of England at that time, I mean, I think even little children were politicized. Everybody knew. And nobody thought we were going to lose. That was so amazing.
Getting back to the repressive atmosphere that is in
yeah,
in
you're
a
really
lot
hung
of your
up
work.
On repression, aren't
well,
you?
Well, no, it's that it's in so much of your work. I figure it must be something that, you've experienced and thought about a lot. I was wondering what kinds of things you were punished for when you were young.
Being naughty. I don't know, the ordinary things. There would be a smack or being uppity. Or I mean, it was. I had the. I do happen to have. I mean, just objectively speaking, no immodesty or any of that. Just as a measurement, I do have a sort of off the scale IQ, and I did. I was obviously very, very bright as a child. As a result, in a way that you know probably wasn't understood at that time, and it is a curse actually in a small, tight, suffocatingly interned, simple-ish working-class village to be, quote, clever, unquote, and to seek education in that way. And that
why is it a curse?
Well, because you will get bullied, won't you? If the teacher leaving the room says, come out to the front, Dennis, and tell us a story, that sounds like an honor. It's actually a punishment because you're going to be resented by the others. And I assumed that I was going to grow up and be a coal miner. They did and did. I didn't. I went through that treacherous minefield called the English class system, which involves betrayal. You don't know it at the time. You're too young to know it. I came from a culture that with a very strong dialect where people do and still do say thee and thou, you know, where bist thou going, O butty, or Surrey, they say, which is Sirrah. And it's only, 40 miles or so from Shakespeare's birthplace. And the accents of the people, which is also naturally in tune with the accents of the King James Bible, and that wonderful, simple English, which is resonant, aching with beauty and tenderness. And but to go in that from there all the way by accident and examination to Oxford involves you making judgments about your own without knowing you're making, because you are seduced into making those judgments by what you think is of just learning and education. It does mean that you are trapped into making value judgments about your own home.
Is success interpreted as turning your back against your own class?
Well, it can be, and it is when you're very young. And if you start making judgments, because if you start thinking that an ability to speak Latin somehow, for example, makes you better than someone who doesn't and can't, or if you know more, or if you read more, or if you seek those things, you can, by the very arrogance of youth, you can be trapped into making those false judgments, and it's only later that you receive the pain of knowing that you have, although you've gained so much, you've also lost something. When I was used to, my dad is dead now. Died in 1975, and he didn't read and things, but he was an incredibly gentle and sensitive man whose life was spent in the pits. But when he'd talked about something in the past, he would somehow describe the color of the sky, or sometimes he'd draw an apple on the white margins of a newspaper. And when I would be writing, after I'd started writing television plays and so on, sometimes I would be trying to finish something, and he'd come out and he would lean on the door jamb looking into the room where I was working, and I maybe was sort of slightly irritated, thinking, I don't actually want a conversation at this moment, I want to finish this scene, say, and he would say, "Is thou all right, oh, but Dan, you all right?" And I'd say, "Yes, thank you, Dad." "You sure you're all right now?" Within that accent. And of course now, if I could only say, "Oh, please, Dad, come on in."
Yeah.
But you can't, can you? But you can have a continuing relationship with the dead. Any parish includes the dead as well as the living.
We're featuring a 1992 interview with Dennis Potter, who died earlier today of cancer. He wrote the TV series The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1992 interview with Dennis Potter, who died earlier today. The main character in your screenplay, The Singing Detective, has a condition that combines psoriasis and arthritis, yeah, which is the condition that you have. When did you first get that?
30 years ago. It's like a plague, you know. People say, "Oh, I've got psoriasis," people say, and they mean they've got a few rings or scales on their skin. Whereas this kind is the killer kind, 100%. You cannot find a gap in your, you know, when it attacks first. It started actually with the arthritis in every single joint, went just like that. I was actually on this newspaper, the Daily Herald, which I'd left the BBC because I wanted politics, and obviously you cannot express political opinions as a staff member of the BBC. And I was covering a political conference at the press table. I was feeling a bit low anyway. I was sort of wallowing towards what I knew was a kind of desperate disappointment with things in general, without being able to say what specifically it was. But when I went to get up from the press table, I suddenly couldn't. I looked down, thinking, what the hell's wrong? And my left knee, which is where it was like a football. You know, it was literally 4 or 5 times its proper size within half an hour or so. And I didn't know what it was. And it, in fact, took some time to diagnose properly what it was. And during that time, bang, I just went. And then my hands collapsed in. And it's still active, so I can't have those little rubber joints put in. So I can just move the forefinger and thumb. The other fingers are permanently down on the palm. But then, you know, with the steroid, you know, that long regime of treatment over... I'm talking now, this is the winter of 61, 62, and it began. I had 2 small children, and I had lost my job. In a way, I was lucky in that at the same time, I knew that I had to... In a way, it sounds crude, but I'm using it as a metaphor. I had to reinvent myself. I had to find... in myself, what it was, A, what it was that I was so wretchedly disappointed about without knowing what it was, if you follow me. But also, I'd always had this sense of, it's such an old-fashioned word, it makes people snigger, but of vocation, that there was some significance. And now that's perilously close to mental illness when you too readily admit to that condition. You're saying when you know that there is some significance to your life and that there is a vocation to which you should submit. The sheer desperation of that kind of opened up the entry to a path that began to stretch ahead of me instead of behind me. So far from things seeming to be over, you know, and that one would be in a permanently medical nightmare, there actually was something stretching in front of me and beckoning me, and I submitted to it. It's the only way I can put it.
In The Singing Detective, your character, who has the same condition you do, says, "I've reached the end of my tether. I can't see clear of it. Even tears hurt the skin of my face. Mm. Talk about the Book of Job. I'm a prisoner of my own skin and bones." Mm. Was there a period where you felt that you reached the end of your tether?
No, not like that. I mean, that's an invention of... I mean, in The Singing Detective, I wanted to show a man with nothing except bitterness and rage reassemble himself via... is cheap fiction and cheap music. I mean, they weren't the whole sources of his beginnings of self-knowledge. But through concentrating, in order to escape the pain and the humiliation of that scourge of an illness, he was remembering or trying to rewrite his own cheap detective pulp novel.
He has these fevered visions and hallucinations. Mm. Have you ever had that, and have you written your way
when the illness is at its height, you're not actually hallucinating, but you do lose. Reality does shift in front of you. is an unpleasant. It's a bit like dreaming, but you know you are. You never actually, you never don't know the difference between what is real and what isn't. But it is an uneasy. You feel that at any moment you're going to lose what is real and what isn't. That doesn't last too long. But once you experience it, you do know how perilously perched your rationality can be. You are perforce made to live in your body, and your body can let you down.
Just one last question about your condition. How has it changed your life to be able to not be bedridden and embarrassed to be seen in the way that you used to be?
Well, I have a tendency towards reclusiveness. I know that. And I know that that too can, although it's nice in a way for me, it can be dangerous. And I like, it's one of the, maybe one of the hidden reasons why I wanted to direct, you suddenly have to say hello and deal with hundreds of people. And in a very emotional way, I mean a very hard working, I mean a very concentrated way. You have to be out and dealing and functioning. That, maybe I've had enough of that reclusiveness, and it's nice to be like I was at Oxford or before, you know, when I was going to be a public man, a political man, as it were. I don't mean glad-handing, but, you know, being out and about in the world is nice, and I'm responding to it, and it's a good creative feeling, and I'm very lucky.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you so much for spending some of your time with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dennis Potter died today of cancer at the age of 59. Our interview was recorded in 1992. His TV series included Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective. The entire Dennis Potter collection is available for viewing at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. The museum is currently screening an interview with Dennis Potter, broadcast in April on England's Channel 4, called Without Walls. And Lipstick on Your Collar, a musical miniseries from 1993, also seen on Channel 4. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.